This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Our fabulous fundraising day here on KBOO, your community radio station. I want to thank Stuart Perrin for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, honey.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Friday, July 19th from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., tune in for KBOO's one-day flash drive fundraiser, a day filled with news and music from the equator to Antarctica.
Lecture topics will include climate change, gay rights, and an overview of African land grabs. Don't miss out on the chance to explore underrepresented music and news from across the Southern Hemisphere on July 19th from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogring, and the show is Fight the Empire. And we have an interesting program prepared. It's all about, well, we'll get into that when we get into it. Our guest is Tamu Ruskola, who is a law professor at Emory University. And he's written a very interesting book on legal orientalism. So, Tamu Ruskola, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
So why don't we just start right out? What exactly is Orientalism?
Well, Orientalism is it's not my original idea, but there's a famous literary scholar, Edward Said, who used that term to describe the way in which we tend to think about kind of East and West as these opposites. So usually or often the West is associated, you know, with individual rights, being kind of progressive and so forth, whereas the East then tends to be associated with collectivism, despotism, sometimes traditional stagnance. So even though there are these kind of opposite characterizations, they're actually usually not totally neutral or symmetrical. Usually the positive side of the opposite binary belongs to the West and the negative one to the East. So I use the idea of legal orientalism to think about why is it that I think the U.S. in particular is today often associated with the rule of law, whereas a lot of people, when they think of China, actually one of the things I teach is Chinese law. So when I tell people I teach Chinese law, they will often say, what? There is no such thing. So I really became interested in thinking about why do we associate China with, despotism, human rights violations, and the U.S. kind of automatically with the rule of law.
Well, why do we? I mean, aside from just kind of sort of human nature that we're better than everybody else, you know, everybody sort of thinks their own country is the best in the world.
Well, that is actually a really interesting question. That really is what the book is about. And I think a lot of these reasons really are kind of historical. Although it's interesting, when the image of China in particular, has actually changed quite a bit, because when you first started getting more or less reliable information from China was actually in the 16th century with Jesuit missionaries, and they had a very positive image of China. They told everybody in Europe how great these Chinese political institutions were, and it's really in the course of late 18th, 19th century that the image starts getting very negative. Mm-hmm. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, for example, in England, a lot of the information came from the traders that were there with the East India Company. And the Jesuits, you know, were kind of very well-educated men who learned Chinese, understood Chinese institutions. But the East India Company men, they kind of complained that China didn't understand free trade or all the commercial practices that they were used to in Europe. So that's when the image of Chinese law kind of goes into into decline.
What about even earlier? What about Marco Polo?
Well, Marco Polo is an interesting guy.
Was he real? He really went to China, I believe. Although it seems to me I've heard some people say it was all a kind of a big hoax, but I don't know. Is it?
Well, I don't know the answer either. I think there's some debate among historians, actually, you know, to what extent he's a historical figure and where exactly he went. But he wasn't really, the information that he provided didn't necessarily focus so much on law. And, of course, at that time, China was governed by the foreign Mongol dynasty. So I don't think Marco Polo had, mm-hmm. and in general, the images that he conveyed were actually quite positive. He said Chinese cities are, you know, huge, large, well-organized, well-regulated. So I think it's the bad rep that comes later.
Well, see, it's interesting to me that here's one of the oldest civilizations in the world, and they're being put down as kind of backward. I don't quite understand that.
Well, I think that's the thing. Like when early modern period, when these observers went to China, this is you know, the Renaissance period, when, you know, it's a discovery of classical antiquity in Europe, for example. So antiquity was a good thing, kind of these classical institutions. But by the time you get to 18th and 19th century, you get this idea of progress that and change, and then the idea that these Chinese ancient institutions haven't changed over time. Instead of just traditional, they become quote unquote stagnant and so forth. So then all the qualities that had once been a good thing, they actually become negatively valued. So it's not so much that people learn new facts about China, they just kind of reinterpret what those qualities mean.
So what are some of the features of legal Orientalism? I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the United States claims to, you know, kind of uphold universal values as opposed to, I suppose, what, particularist values or local values, or what is the contention there?
I think the contention is very much that that the idea that rule of law really means individual rights. And in China, of course, historically, emphasis has been on the collective rather than individual. So there is this sense that the state decides everything and individual citizens or subjects have very few rights. So the idea that that's why Chinese law is, quote unquote, arbitrary, it's despotic, and so forth. Although a lot of this opposition is kind of ideological, because, of course, neither individual rights nor Chinese collective values, neither of those are absolute. I mean, we all know that, yes, you have the right to free speech, but that doesn't mean that you can, you know, yell fire in a theater, right? Or you have the right to private property, but that doesn't mean that you have the right to own an atomic bomb. So in practice, of course, you know, we always take the collective interest into account anyway. In China, they just start from the opposite. They start with the collective duties to the collective, and then in practical situations, they modify those to take into account individual persons and how they fit into the context. So in some ways, it's neither system really is as absolute as is kind of ideologically presented, but we just tend to emphasize those differences rather than areas where there might also be similarities.
So what collective sort of operates in China? Are we talking about the family or the dynasty or what?
Well, the preeminent collective, of course, historically is the family, which has served as the model for a lot of other social and even economic institutions. In theory, at least, you know, the emperor was actually not supposed to be just like this all-powerful despot. He was supposed to be a parental figure, kind of pater familias, who, yes, was, you know, in a superior position, but also owed duties to those below him. It was his duty to take care of his subjects and make sure that they were okay. And even in the economic sphere, family was the kind of the preeminent model. So, for example, one of the examples I discuss in my book is there are a lot of people who argue, for example, the sociologist Max Weber. He says that part of the reason why capitalism did not develop indigenously in China he says it's because the Chinese didn't have the idea of the corporation as a legal person, the legal fiction of the corporation as a person, and therefore they were stuck with these family businesses. It actually turns out, if you do a little look at some of the work that anthropologists have done and so forth, it turns out that a lot of these, what I call clan corporations, actually were not families. There were a lot of people who would kind of get together, pool their capital, and sometimes doctor their genealogies, invent a long-shared ancestor. So it turns out that actually in China, they had the legal fiction of family and kinship to justify corporations, where we had the legal fiction of the corporation as an individual person. So in some ways, these entities were actually functionally similar, but they were just justified by very different kind of ideological and legal means.
Well, I would argue that the reason capitalism developed in the West was basically two reasons. One was this huge kind of the free lunch of the New World, you know, these untapped resources which are there for the grabbing. And the other was the economic a gift provided by slavery. That's what allowed capitalism to develop. And I guess China did not have that, or did not have that to the same extent that that the West had.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of debate, of course, about this topic. But I mean, I think people do. There's widespread agreement that that's certainly part of the gift that European capitalism did not develop indigenously. And, you know, the great gift was, you know, the discovery of the New World, the resources and so forth that it provided. So clearly that's at least big part of the explanation.
So in a way, these other reasons are kind of like the excuses or the justifications or the rationales or the kind of frosting on the cake or something.
Well, I think often there's sort of a people, for example, economic historians note that in many ways, in the early modern period, actually, and certainly late Middle Ages, China was actually far more advanced economically than Europe. So, and it had, at least in many of the elements that are regarded as kind of prerequisites for the development of capitalism. So the question is, why didn't China develop them? It did have, for example, the capacity to go discover new worlds, and they could have gone around colonizing the world, but didn't. So often the explanation is that, well, they just didn't have the kind of ingenuity or the institutions or whatever, and that's part of the explanation, that they were kind of too stagnant, traditional, backward-looking, rather than inventive, progressive, forward-looking. Although, of course, even in that regard, it's interesting to think about, because so many of the things that we associate with kind of the West and the West advantage in this thing, for example, you know, superior weapons and so forth, educational institutions and so forth. Well, I mean, paper was invented by the Chinese. Gunpowder was invented by the Chinese. So much of what we actually think of kind of achievements of European civilization, both materially and intellectually, actually, of course, come from all around the world.
Well, couldn't you argue that the fact that the Chinese did not set out to conquer the world was, that would be a point in their favor, I would think.
But they had a certain modesty
about themselves, that they didn't want to kind of inflict their culture on other people.
Well, modesty is probably not the right word, because, of course, mm-hmm. Historically, the Chinese are very Sinocentric, just mm-hmm. as, you know, Westerners tend to be Eurocentric. But, I mean, the flip side of it, in a sense, it was, one might say, what some European observers call their arrogance that kept them from colonizing, because they thought if they are the center of civilization, other people should come to them. Why should they bother, you know, go around all over the world improving the situation of the barbarians? Mm-hmm. And, of course, China was an empire. They did colonize their immediate neighbors. So, I mean, there's clearly, I think, something like two-thirds of the territorial area of China today belongs to these so-called minority nationalities. So in that sense, China was clearly an empire, but it just didn't go for these far away overseas colonies, which, of course, we know were governed extremely brutally.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Temu Ruscola, who is a professor of law at Emory University and the author of a book called Legal Orientalism. So why don't we talk about how the this is something I didn't know. The U.S. had a court for China, its own court out there in Shanghai. How to tell us about that?
Well, it is a very interesting story that people in the U.S. don't know much about, although in China people are quite aware. So when the British finally sort of forced China to enter into quote-unquote free trade in the Opium War in 1839, well, after the war ended 1842, actually, not only did the British insist on trade access to China, but they also said that Chinese law is too barbaric, too despotic to apply to the British, so they said they must have the right of what they called extraterritorial jurisdiction, which was simply to say that even when the British were in China, they should only be subject to British law and not to Chinese law. Well, 2 years later, when the U.S. enters into its first treaty with China, actually the U.S. ends up getting and asking for the same provision, not just trade access, but also the right of extraterritorial jurisdiction for Americans. And this really meant that from 1844, formerly, until 1943, now for 99 years, Americans in China were actually not subject to Chinese law. So for the first 50-some years, almost 60 years, what the Americans did is basically was follow the European model, which was that, you know, there would be a couple of kind of merchant consuls, these kind of, you know, semi-diplomatic officials in various cities in China, and these officials would adjudicate disputes among their own countrymen. But this system was very corrupt, and most of these consuls were not lawyers, they were not really able to control, especially the American community as it grew larger, and there were more kind of lawbreakers and shady characters. So in 1906, the U.S. Congress created the so-called United States Court for China, which had jurisdiction over Americans in what they called the District of China, which consisted of the Chinese Empire at the time. So this U.S. Court for China really developed a pretty amazing jurisprudence as it adjudicated these disputes involving Americans in China. And ironically, actually, even though a big part of the justification for this court was that indeed Chinese law was supposed to be too despotic and arbitrary, well, it turns out that this court essentially made up its own body of law. It was supposed to be applied, the Congress has just told it to apply U.S. law. But, for example, you know, most of the kind of common law disputes are actually governed by state law, not federal law. So they didn't know which state law should you apply in China. It's not a state in the union. So they ended up applying, for example, the municipal code of the District of Columbia and the territorial code of the territory of Alaska. So it really became, and the Americans in China complained bitterly, and they said, well, this system of so-called American law is as bad or worse than Chinese law.
Yeah, talk about arbitrary.
Indeed.
So why don't we kind of jump ahead to sort of the situation now? You have a very interesting epilogue by colonialism without the colonizers. And this is interesting because 2 weeks ago, my guest was Pepe Escobar, who writes for the Asia Times. And we were discussing sort of the American dream and the Chinese dream. And in some ways, the Chinese dream is very similar to the American dream, you know, kind of more consumer goods and urbanism and a whole bunch of stuff. And I see some of that. Seems to me like you're talking a little bit about the same thing with trade laws and all that. So why don't we go into that?
Yeah, I mean, that's also just really interesting and important change, clearly. So initially, of course, the Chinese resented this imposition of Western legal institutions on them. And, of course, it's quite ironic, you know, in 1839, you know, China, in the Opium War, China had to be indeed forced to enter into free trade against its will. Well, by the time you get to the World Trade Organization, I mean, China was banging on its door to get in. So clearly, you know, something has changed, and China has, after the imperial state collapses in 1911, China certainly made the Republic of China made a self-conscious decision to sort of reconstitute itself on the model of kind of Western European sovereign state recognized under Western international law. So that, of course, also means that in order to qualify under that system, you really have to have certain basic legal institutions, economic and social structures. So that's what we witness today. In my book, I call this system or this phenomenon self-orientalism. A lot of both the kind of liberal as well as right or left, really, Chinese legal thinkers, they all tend to think that what China needs is, quote-unquote, modern legal institutions, which means legal institutions exported from the West. So in that sense, I think China is at least in kind of formal regards becoming more and more like the West. Obviously, these institutions, even if they are transplanted in China, they are not identical. But a lot of Chinese today, a lot of modern Chinese, do share this kind of prejudice against what I call Oriental despotism or this idea of legal Orientalism.
Well, it seems to me you find some of that in Marxism. You know, Marx himself had a great admiration for what capitalist society of his time had done, you know, all sorts of progress. And there was sort of this idea that you can't get socialism until you sort of pass through this capitalist stage, you know, that it's necessary.
Absolutely. I mean, Marx was very much, you know, a great thinker, but a product, I think, very much of the 19th century in the sense that his theory was this kind of modern developmental one, right? That you can't get to socialism until you get to capitalism. And that's why he said, indeed in print, that, you know, well, you know, colonialism is regrettable, but the good thing about, you know, British imperialism is that it's destroying these, you know, ancient Indian villages and their kind of despotic oppressive culture. So it's very much in keeping with the Marxian view that does inform the People's Republic of China and its kind of political constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly, in fact, if you look at the constitution of China today, enacted in 1982, the current constitution, the preamble actually states that that China today, in order to justify the current economic and legal reforms, they say that China for the foreseeable future is in the primary stage of socialism, which means really capitalism, because you can't get to the end of socialism until you go through capitalism. So the Chinese state is also very much making use of this idea.
Well, this kind of raises a very interesting, I think a very fundamental question where, you know, a lot of, you know, economists and others say that, you know, a sort of an indigenous society will never needs some kind of a prod from the outside. It needs some sort of a civilizing encounter to progress. Where I think, I don't know, my belief is that colonialism actually puts a lid, it puts a damper on developing that indigenous society. In other words, like when we came and overwhelmed the Indian cultures here in the West, that forever precluded them from developing their own cultures. You know, we imposed our culture on them, and it's still happening today, but it meant that they could never develop on their own, and who knows what they might have done, you know?
Absolutely, and that's really kind of what I mean by the title of my last chapter, which is, as you noted, is called Colonialism Without Colonizers. It is this idea that these certain types of political and economic institutions really have become totally hegemonic in the modern world. In order to have a state and be recognized as having a state, you have to organize in a certain way. And there really is no outside, really, to capitalism and the kind of world trade system today. I mean, either you're in it or you're poor. So obviously it doesn't mean that, you know, everything has become totally homogenized and the same everywhere, far from it, but there are really certain institutions that really are globally hegemonic in just the way you describe.
Well, all these economies have to kind of dance to the same tune.
Yes, well, that's interesting that you say that, because I've had a bit of a debate with some friends of mine, because if you look at some of these kind of 19th century, kind of what I call classical Orientalists, European scholars and so forth, whether they're scholars of India or China or what have you, they clearly had a lot of the kind of problematic assumptions of their time about developmentalism, progress, you know, kind of development stage by stage. But to their credit, they actually did have a lot of local information. They actually spent time in these countries, decades often as scholars or administrators. They learned the language. They actually had a lot of respect for local culture and civilization. Whereas today, I think, you know, a lot of these kind of economists sitting in elite political institutions, I mean, they really have one model that is supposed to be applicable everywhere. So to that extent, I was sort of debating, you know, which is better, the World Bank economists or the old-school Orientalists. So at least the old-school Orientalists had more actual knowledge of the conditions of the place he or she, usually he, was talking about.
Well, I think the Western version is heading for collapse myself. It's just one example I just read about recently about Egypt. You know, Juan Cole talks about this, how, you know, the IMF, you know, this modernizing philosophy, when it hit Egypt, it meant that the Egyptians, they kind of paved all their farmland along the Nile in order to build these wonderful cities and everything, and now they can no longer feed themselves because they paved over their farmland. This seems to be a very self-defeating economy.
Yeah, and of course people have. I mean, like, everybody's awed by the Chinese miracle, and it is awesome. Mm-hmm. But there are clearly, you know, concerns about its long-term sustainability in terms of what it's doing to the environment, what it's doing to people's health, and so forth. So, I mean, if I had to bet money, I would bet it on the Chinese economy rather than Europe or North America. But I think there are going to be some major bumps along the way.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you see? What do you see coming? I mean, China seems to be, an up and coming power, and the U.S. and Europe seem to be really kind of declining. Do you think see that kind of projecting forward, or what?
I do think that is the long-term trajectory. If you look back globally, you could argue that, 19th century was the British century, and 20th century in many ways the American one, and I think clearly the focus is shifting more towards Asia now, but I think that's the long term forecast. But in terms of trying to forecast the weather for tomorrow, I just don't know, because I think China is just so enormously complicated, and people have made all kinds of predictions about how things would evolve. And I think that is actually a major difference when you look at the trajectory, a kind of a post Cold War trajectory of, say, versus Eastern Europe versus China. Because, of course, in Eastern Europe, in Russia in particular, you know, they had this big bang approach. You know, you can't have incremental change. You have to introduce all capitalist institutions at once. You have to privatize everything at once, which means everything was basically looted by these handful of officials. Well, China started with its economic reforms started in 1978 with very modest, relatively modest agricultural reforms, and then it's just been incremental. Nobody really had a big blueprint. And it's sort of been a sort of step by step. Let's see how this goes, and I do see that continuing at least for some time.
Well, one thing I think we can fairly safely foresee is that our resources, especially oil, are getting cheap, more and more expensive, and that has all kinds of implications. But I think we're going to have to leave it there. This is the end of the show. We've been talking with Teemu Ruskola, who is a professor of law at Emory University and author of Legal Orientalism. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And this is Fight the Empire. Stay tuned for, I believe, Air Cascadia is coming up next. Stay tuned.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Just a minute now before 10 o'clock. And in 15 minutes at 10:15 on Flashpoints, law professor Marjorie Cohn talks about forbidding the mention of racial profiling in the George Zimmerman trial. And former Black Panther Kilu Nyasha talks about Trayvon Martin and the extreme racism that surrounds the case. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Gene Bradley speaks with mystery writer Craig Johnson about his latest book in the Walt Longmire mystery series, A Serpent's Tooth. And then at 11:30, Dan Johnson speaks with poet Andrea Hollander, recipient of a 2013 Oregon Literary Fellowship, about her latest book, Landscape with Female Figure, a collection of selected poems. Up next, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
PDX Pop Now returns for their 2013 festival from July 19th to July 21st, located at East Bank Lot on the corner of Southeast Water and Salmon. It's an all-ages event showcasing Portland's incredibly diverse musical talent. Bringing the festival to two outdoor stages for the very first time, the three-day event will feature 45 bands, a food court, activity area, Riggs Ball, a street fair, and even more, making this the biggest and most interactive festival experience yet in the history of this event. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.